Southern Songs and Stories is a documentary series on the artists, music, and culture of the South, with interviews, songs, a good bit of history, and insights into how all of it fits together. I'm your host, Joe Kendrick, inviting you to come explore the music of the South and the artists who make it on Southern Songs and Stories.
I'm Ben Sawyer, and this is The Road to Now. Today's episode is a re-air of a conversation we had back in 2017 with New York Times bestselling author Nicholas Carr. The topic of Nicholas's work is the internet and technology and the way it affects our brains and the way it affects the way we interact. And I thought that this might be a good time to re-air this episode. You know, a lot of us are in our houses now. Most of us are in our houses now, and a lot of our work has gone from being in person to online. A lot of our communications with others, with loved ones, a lot of our relationships have gone online. And in so many ways, this has been a gift. I can't imagine now not being able to see my family members, see my friends, get to do the things that we do. Heck, even have this podcast. And that is all possible because of this amazing technology. But as we are in the middle of this period of life with an epidemic all around us, and we are becoming deeper and deeper enmeshed in this internet world, I thought it's good to make sure that we reflect on the cons of this. Now, that's not to say we shouldn't be doing this. Of course we're going to do it. I guess to say it best, don't let yourself become convinced that this is something that can replace things. You know, we human beings are quick to adjust. That's one of our greatest gifts. We can live in the Arctic. We can live at the equator. But some adjustments, we'll convince ourselves they're okay, but they in the end, they won't fulfill us in the same ways. So I just thought that at this time where we're all appreciative of that technology, we should remember the value of what we do when we meet in person and the collaborations, the feelings, the love that you can feel in person. That's not to say we should be thinking about the fact that we can't have that now. We will get that back, but only if we choose to. I myself have been dealing with this, teaching online, recording lectures. I've been lucky enough to have students who have come and sit in on Zoom meetings while I lecture to them. And I can't imagine, I tried to record one lecture just staring at a computer monitor. It was terrible. So I am so thankful that I have these students and that I'm able to deliver to them the knowledge that I want to share. But friends, let's remember, this is, I can feel it. I can feel it. I don't know if you can too, but it just doesn't deliver the same thing. And so many of my students have expressed that to me, that the experience of learning online is not the way they learn. And that's not surprising because honestly, we're humans. We learn from each other and in person usually is the best way to do that. And from an educator's perspective, I'm worried that at the end of this, people who see what we do as a factory, people who see my job as checking boxes on a transcript, and I am concerned that the people who run a lot of educational institutions, the people who tend to see the work that I do as checking a box, tend to look at the university as a business or a factory type system or any school that way, for that matter, I'm concerned that they are going to look at the fact that we delivered what they care about and not see what's missing. And so I encourage all of you, keep working hard. As I've said so many times, we have to think about what we can do and not what we can't do. But be prepared. Be prepared to stand together and defend these relationships we have, these in-person things. And just watch out for it. I'm concerned that it will be coming from different directions. But also, don't think I'm saying there's a conspiracy theory here. For goodness sakes, go back and listen to the last episode if you have any questions about that. I'm simply saying that that sometimes what we call, quote, progress is not what we hoped it would be, and it doesn't fulfill a lot of what we need as people. So I just thought today would be a great episode to share this back with you. Now, here's the trick. Actually, if you'll notice your feed, there are a lot of older episodes available. In fact, between now and June 1st, to share what we have with all of you, we've made almost all of our back catalog available to the public. Episodes 1 through 75 have only been available to patrons up until now. For this period, we will make them available to everyone. So go back and listen to the older episodes. There are some fantastic episodes in there. And if this helps you guys move forward, you know, listen to the old episodes, learn something new, and remember that there were times when we didn't even know what this was and that we will get through this again. So we hope you enjoy those previous episodes, and let us know which ones you like. If you want to tweet at us and say, hey, I really enjoyed this one, that would be great. And if you want us to have some of these authors back on, let us know. We'd love to have lots of previous guests back on. It's always just a matter of time. So you can check those out. Also want to let everyone know that if you're thinking, hey, I'm a patron, and that was one of the perks. Yeah, well, we've got a new one right now. Just kicked it off a couple days ago. I think we said something about this in a previous episode, but we are beginning to do live Zoom interviews. And the way this works is that we will post a code, a meeting link through Zoom, where you can come be an audience member for our interviews, see us doing them live, see what it looks like before Gary Fletcher gets a hold of these things and makes them all shiny. And so join us. Also, we're going to hopefully be able to do questions from the audience in the chat box. So the first one of those, we're very excited to announce, will be Thursday, this coming Thursday. If you listen to this on Monday the 20th, it's going to be the 23rd, Thursday at 10:30 a.m. Eastern, 7:30 a.m. Pacific. We're going to be talking to my colleague and friend, Mark Doyle from MTSU. He's just written a new book on the Kinks, the band, and it's gotten great reviews. It just got reviewed in the Wall Street Journal. And I have been asking Mark when this book is coming out for a while. As a lot of you know, books take a while to come out. It's out, and he'll be our first guest. Just to clarify, we won't be able to do these with all of the authors and the guests we have. We'll always go with what they want to do. So, you know, if there's some that we can't do, we apologize. But everyone who agrees to it, we will make it happen because, honestly, it sounds like a lot of fun to have you guys there. So that will be available for our Hamiltonian members and above. Just an extra perk for those of you guys who chip in. And thank you so much for supporting us. That has kept us going. It really has. Just also want to say real quick here, I have been doing episodes, live streaming episodes of my comedy game show, Perfect Timing. And this is a great collaboration that I've been doing with Zany's Comedy Club. Lucy Sensheimer over there, a good friend of mine, hit me up and said, you want to try to do some of these to help raise money for the servers who are out of work? And I said, all I've been doing is trying to think how to help people who are out of work. So we've done two of those now. It's been great. We've had guests we've had on, Gareth Reynolds from The Dollop. We've had Joe Dombrowski, Mr. D, who's, you know, been on Ellen and has his own podcast. Jared Freed. We've had Brian Babylon, who you know from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. It has been a blast. And all of those are available at Perfect Timing's Facebook page. So you can just go look for Perfect Timing there. And the live streams are all available. And we will also be doing... almost certainly, it looks like we're going to be making this a regular thing. So go check those out, and we hope you'll join us. And that's, you know, that's a comedy thing, right? It's a different side of me. I always say Dr. Sawyer and Mr. Hyde. So you can come enjoy that. And for Bob Crawford, I got to say thank you guys for listening to this, for listening to our podcast, for all the feedback. We are all in isolation mode, and just getting the nice emails and tweets you guys have been sending us has meant a lot. We hope to see you soon, but we will see you again. We'll be all right. Take care. Nicholas Carr, welcome to The Road to Now.
Thanks very much. My pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you here. One of the things I love about your work is we live in a world where it seems like the powers that be have nothing but positive things to say about technology and the internet and all of its, you know, applications. And, you know, the general characterization of people who are not comfortable with technology is that they're, you know, they're backwards, they're reactionary, they're Luddites, they're just not happy and they don't want to get with the program. And yet you have a criticism and a critique of what technology is doing to us that is not reactive, but it is incredibly proactive and incredibly intelligent. So if you could start off by just explaining to us, what is it about the internet and the technology that's come from it that you see as worthy of critique?
Yeah, and, you know, I should start by saying, you know, I grew up with computers and have always found them fascinating and really enjoyed them. And so I don't come to my criticism of the technology out of any kind of fear or reaction against computers. But what's happened over time is, I think, the personal computer has been transformed in a way from a tool that an individual could use to get to accomplish certain things, creative things, productive things, to becoming more of a medium that wraps us in a particular kind of environment. So now we're kind of always connected, always online, constantly interacting with our computer or our phone or social media and so forth. And what I realized, and this started by kind of exploring my own habits and my own thoughts in when I've used computers, is I became concerned that the technology was encouraging superficial thinking, a kind of growing dependency on apps and software to get even to get pretty much anything done in our lives, and was essentially creating this culture of what I call distraction and dependency. That seemed exactly the opposite of what I what I enjoyed about computers to begin with. And so I began, you know, becoming more skeptical and critical of the technology.
And you've written a lot about the research about, you know, one, what this does to our brains, and two, the problems that come, you know, from essentially creating a platform that we rely upon that is run by a very small group of people. And I just picked up your most recent book of essays, Utopia is Creepy, which is great. And you start off, your first essay is about Web 2.0. It's called The Amorality of Web 2.0. Could you explain to us, what is Web 2.0? How is it different than what came before? And what makes it amoral?
Sure. So you have to go back a little more than 10 years ago. There was the great internet bubble of the late 1990s and into 2000, 2001 that collapsed. And for a while in the early years of our new century, people were very down on the internet. They had thought it kind of had peaked and so forth. And then around 2004, 2005, the nature of the internet and I think the nature of personal computing changed with the arrival of social media. And back then, this was called Web 2.0 to distinguish it, of course, from, you know, the first decade of the web that hadn't ended well. And so Web 2.0 was what we now refer to as the social web, social networking, Facebook, Twitter, all of those things. And back then, in around 2005, which is when I started my own blog, there was all this utopian thinking about social media. And it would democratize media, it would pull power away from big centralized corporations and give everyone a voice, and it would lead to greater harmony and deeper discussions. And what we've seen since then, I think, is that it's much, much more complicated than that. Yes. And in fact, in many ways, the so-called Web 2.0 or social media has had the opposite effect. It's kind of led to greater polarization, political polarization, social polarization. It's true that it's damaged a lot of big media companies, particularly print media companies, but in their place, we have these even larger centralized corporations like Google, like Facebook, like Amazon, like Apple, that increasingly control the flow of information, entertainment, political information, news, as well as just our day-to-day conversations. And so what I argued in that particular essay is that we shouldn't assume that technology is beneficial or that it's moral or that it's naturally ethical. Right. We should assume it's amoral. That really, what it comes down to is how these systems are designed, how they're used, and that determines whether they end up being good or bad. And it's not just the technology itself that is necessarily a force for good in society.
Yeah, that, and I think it's amazing that with these things we have to make claims like that, right? I mean, we essentially understand that every technology in itself is neutral. It's all how we use it. And yet this is the kind of stuff that, you know, as I myself am a history professor, and I lecture, and I incorporate, you know, learning tools into my classes through the readings. But I lecture in class, and I use PowerPoint and things like that. But I don't allow any of my students to use any cell phones in the class. I don't allow them to use computers, except for in very rare cases. And, you know, this is, for me, based on research that I've done that has demonstrated, for example, that when you type notes, you don't process them. You know, handwriting matters.
Right.
And learning to concentrate and build community instead of living online are better things. Yet I think sometimes when I tell people that, even within my own academic community, they're like, oh, come on, get with the program, man. Why are you holding back? You know, yeah. as if the technology is inherently this positive thing.
Right. I mean, unfortunately, and again, I say this completely acknowledging that good technology can have very good effects, but there's this confusion that we as a society, I think, have arrived at where we equate technological progress with social and cultural progress. So, you know, as long as we get a new iPhone, you know, model every year or two, then everything's going along fine. And it seems to me, you know, you can understand this because, you know, new gadgets are cool and we kind of gravitate toward them and stuff. And so we imbue them with this sense of that they must be beneficial, that as long as they're getting better, everything must be getting better. And it kind of turns off our natural critical mind and skepticism. And I really think at this point, given the enormous role these technologies are playing in our lives and in society, we need to be much more critical and much more skeptical about how they're designed, what the motivations of the companies behind them are, and how we're using them personally.
Yeah, let me tell you how many times I've heard someone say, when we talk about the gap between the rich and poor in the United States growing, how many times I've heard people say, well, you know, even the poorest people can get a smartphone now, right? So that must be good.
Right.
it's kind of an interesting mark of civilizational development, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's a perfect symptom of the misperception that I'm talking about, or the confusion.
Yeah, so you say, as Web 2.0 has developed, and what we call Web 2.0 has developed, that this has given more and more power to particular companies. And I think that there's no question about that. And one of your most well-known essays from The Atlantic, I believe it was in 2008, was called "Is Google Making Us Stupid?" And yeah. Could you explain, you know, what is Google's role in all of this?
Well, you know, the title, I focus on Google, but the article is really about the internet in general.
Right.
But I think Google, I think what has underlain Google from the beginning is a belief that if we can get more access to information delivered to us more quickly, then we'll all get smarter.
Right.
Because we'll be able to search for anything and you know, all of this information will be unlocked, stuff that used to be hard to come by. And there's a lot of truth to that. I think all of us would agree that opening up access to information is, in general, a good thing. But what was missing from Google's view, and this became kind of the popular view as well, was an understanding that it isn't just access to information that determines the depth of our thinking. It's how we process that information, how we take it in, how thoughtful we are, how attentive we are. And what turned out is that I believe that the way that companies like Google and Facebook and Twitter and so forth have designed their services, they've designed them in such a way that we're kind of constantly distracted, constantly interrupted, constantly dealing with notifications, many of which are completely trivial, some of which are very important. And what happens is we're so compulsively engaged in information gathering that we never step back from the flow of information and actually think deeply and attentively and calmly about the information we found. And it turns out that, you know, information is a very different thing from knowledge.
Right.
And knowledge requires you to back away from interruptions and distractions and actually, you know, have a calm, attentive mind and go through these things, because it's only then that you create rich associations and connections between the different pieces of information you've collected. And that's what gives, you know, contextual richness to your thinking and ultimately leads to knowledge. You know, the internet provides us great access to information, but it provides that information in a way that defeats our ability to process the information well and to turn it from information into knowledge.
Right. And you've written about how this actually has a real tangible effect on our brains. Could you explain what that tangible effect is?
Yeah. And so it wasn't that long ago that people used to think that, you know, once you hit the age of 20, your brain was pretty much fixed and it didn't change from then on. And what we've learned is through experiments in what's called neuroplasticity, is that throughout our lives, our brains are adapting to the environment that surrounds us. And in particular, what happens is when you develop new habits of thought, they get entrenched in your brain. I mean, in the actual connections between your neurons. And what I argue is that if you think about what the big change in our environment, the environment in which we're doing our thinking, has been over the last 20 years, it's that we've begun using computers and now particularly smartphones to kind of help, I use that word in quotes, with our perception of the world, our gathering of information, our processing of information, our ways of communication. And so I think when you begin to look at the habits of thought that are encouraged by the technology, and as I say, I think they're thought that's distracted and divided attention and so forth, I believe that, you know, it's always been hard for human beings to pay attention.
Right.
Our instinct is to be distracted and glance at the next bright, shiny thing that comes through our field of vision. So this has always been a challenge to kind of turn off the spigot of information and actually, have a coherent train of thought that extends for a long period of time. And I think the net and social media and smartphones have actually made what was already a difficult challenge much, much harder because they do encourage this constant stimulation that tends to encourage us to think superficially rather than to really engage the deep thinking that our minds are make possible.
Yeah, and this is one of the things that fascinates me, how quickly we can adapt as human beings. Because, I mean, that's you know, I always point out to my students in my classes, like, think about this. We're a species that lives at the equator and can survive at the poles. We adapt. We can adapt. That's one of our amazing things. And I remember, you know, when I was in graduate school, before I had my own computer or internet at my house, like in 2005 or 2006, I think I'm revealing exactly how little money I had when I was younger. But, you know, I remember, like, the whole thing would be, you would go to a computer. I remember when I was an undergrad, I had to drive to campus to use a computer. And those early days with this kind of like internet at your fingers, you would notice when you went down like the Wikipedia hole or down the Google hole, you'd just be like, oh my goodness, I just spent like an hour at the library and just read one thing after another, and I jumped from everything. And you would notice that. And now I wonder how many times a week that I do that. And it's just become part of my daily life. And that's, you know, a course of 10 years, the technology. And I don't even notice that anymore.
Right. And I think that is an example. I mean, I think you're absolutely right that we are extraordinarily adaptive animals, physically and mentally. And in general, that's a great thing. I mean, thank goodness we can adapt quickly to changes in our environment. But we have to realize that adaptation is a value neutral process. The process of adaptation doesn't necessarily make us better. It may make us more superficial thinkers if that's what the kind of technology or the environment encourages us to do. And I think that's what's been going on. And I think you're absolutely right that, you know, there was a time, and it wasn't very long ago, that to some degree, your online life was segregated from the rest of your life, and you could be more, you actually had to make a decision to go online and to use these kind of tools. And at least that imposed a certain discipline and encouraged a little critical thinking. Now there's no distinction between, you know, our online lives and our offline lives, because with a constantly connected smartphone that we tend to look at, and this is what studies show, about 100 or 200 times a day, there's just no boundaries anymore.
Yeah, and some of us, if you are roughly my age, which is 38, some of our listeners will remember when your connectivity to the internet relied upon you waiting until your parents went to bed and then plugging your phone line into a modem and dialing it up and connecting to the internet.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can remember, I'm a bit older, but I can remember, you know, getting an America Online account where you had 5 hours of time a month. That was it. And it didn't seem so bad, actually. I kind of wish it was like that again.
Yeah, I mean, and that gets back to the point you were making earlier, and kind of, you know, that has infused this conversation, which is there is something to be said for scarcity. You know, scarcity allows you to budget better. When something is ubiquitous and in many ways, you know, very little cost to accessing it, oftentimes, you know, we don't appreciate what we have. And you know, that's not always a good thing to have a lot of something.
That's right. In a more recent book I wrote called The Glass Cage, I kind of take that argument to the whole area of automation and our dependency on computers and robots and apps to do more and more things in our lives. And we tend to gravitate to that because it gives us this feeling that it's freeing us up and it's making our lives more convenient and it's removing challenges and difficulties from our lives. But it turns out that it's only by coming up against hard challenges and kind of dealing with scarcity and figuring hard things out, and that we both develop rich skills and that we get the satisfaction of overcoming challenges and developing those skills. And so often, and this is a kind of tragic consequence, I think, of our dependence on computers, we're very quick to think that, oh, this app will make my life a little more convenient. And so we start to use it and we don't realize until it's too late that actually it's removed from our lives some of the challenges that gave us an opportunity to develop new talents and to feel the satisfaction that comes from that.
Yeah, the fleeting, the instant gratification, it's already something that I feel like a lot of us have a tendency to want anyway.
Right.
And sometimes with the way the internet allows us to, as my friend Josh Wagner, we talk a lot about these things and we talk about culture. He's a comic. And we talk about the other day, and he's only 25. He's already getting this stodgy notion, but he's like, you know, like 10 years ago, if you wanted to be into something, you had to be into something. You had to go to the library and get a book. You had to read up on it. You had to know it. Now you can be an expert on anything in 15 minutes.
Right. And then you forget it all 15 minutes later.
It's so true. It's like a wave comes up there. It's big and washes right away. I wanted to put this in historical context because, you know, every generation's pretty convinced that the sky is falling. You know, now it's smartphones. But before it was Elvis Presley. Before that, it was hoop and stick. You know, these things are going to ruin our culture. But you make some really compelling points about how this is different from what came before. And in your work, you point out some pretty interesting precedents of people saying a new technology was going to change things, going back as far as Socrates, 400 BC. Could you talk about some of the cases that you bring up in your work and then, you know, how the internet itself and Web 2.0 is different?
Yeah. So, you know, beginning with Socrates, who was really worried that the arrival of reading and writing was going to ruin people's memory. And there was a lot of truth to that. As it turned out, it did, you know, erode people's memory, but it ended up giving us a lot of benefits that he didn't foresee. But it's definitely been a theme in culture that any kind of new technology, particularly a communications technology, a media technology, is resisted, and people fear that it's going to take away something important from their lives or from society. And often it does, but usually what we get in return has been better. And certainly we saw this, for instance, very clearly with the arrival in people's homes of television in the early 1960s. And a lot of people, you know, saw how people behaved in watching TV, thought we'd become these passive consumers of information and entertainment. And again, there was some truth to that, but I think our current technology, internet technology, computer technology, smartphone technology, digital technology in general, is fundamentally different from anything that's come before, even from television. Because, you know, unlike television, people might have watched it a lot, but they didn't watch it continuously.
Right.
You didn't have a TV in front of you when you were in a classroom. You didn't have a TV in front of you when you were at your job. You didn't carry a TV around in your pocket all day. So there were, you know, there were times when you watched TV, when you interacted with this technology for better or for worse. And then there was a lot of time in the day when you weren't. With the smartphone in particular, we're kind of always interacting with the technology. And you can see this in behavioral studies. I mean, particularly for a lot of young people, but I think for people of all ages, often the very first thing they do when they wake up before they get out of bed is look at their smartphone. And the last thing they do before they go to sleep is look at their smartphone. And then, as I said, between 100 or 200 times during the course of the day, they're interacting with their smartphone, you know, every couple of minutes of their waking lives. So we've never had a technology that is so deeply influencing the way we perceive things, the way we think about things, the way we communicate with others as this new digital technology does. So I really think, you know, that that the argument that, oh, people have always worried about technology, so we don't have to worry about this one, I just don't think that that's the proper approach to take when you do have a new technology that is so intimately involved with all aspects of our lives. I think we really owe it to ourselves to look at this technology very critically to see if, you know, it's designed in ways that encourage us to get the most out of our lives and whether we use it in those ways or whether it's just a technology that increasingly encourages us to become more and more dependent and more adapted to it. And so I think this really, we are seeing something new in the world and we should appreciate it as something new in the world.
Yeah. And when you say dependent, you know, that's not just I've read research that suggests that, you know, when we look and we get these updates on our phones, we become so into it that our brains begin to release dopamine and it almost literally does become an addiction.
That's right. I mean, it certainly becomes a compulsion and the reason, you know, that our brain releases dopamine when we find new information or even when we're searching for new information, at least this is what scientists believe, and I think it makes sense, is that, you know, if you go back many millennia ago when we were living in the wild, you wanted to know everything that was going on around you in the environment because that's how you stayed alive. So we have this deep instinct where we're getting rewarded by dopamine, a pleasure-producing brain chemical, whenever we get a new piece of information, and we take this really deep instinct into our new digital environment where there's no end to new things to look at and new bits of information to process. And I don't think, you know, it's a surprise that given that we start to exhibit this compulsive kind of behavior that does start to look like addiction.
So in some ways, the companies that we look to as benevolent suppliers of these things that help us are in some way exploiting our very nature.
I think they're very much doing it. And it doesn't mean that they have necessarily evil intentions. But look, I mean, if you look at the big internet companies, a company like Facebook makes more money the more time you spend online, the more quickly you jump from one piece of information to the next, because that's the more you do that, the more information it collects about you and the more opportunities it has to show you ads. And that's how it makes money, and that's what it's going to pursue. And, you know, Facebook has a whole team of behavioral psychologists that are optimizing the service to keep you hooked.
Yeah, and that explains a lot of it with social media as well, right? Because sites like Facebook, they build in programs that keep you seeing things that make you happy so that you don't storm off, right?
That's right. And, you know, they're very, very sophisticated. One thing we should be concerned about is, you know, it's the algorithms of companies like Facebook that we don't understand because they're treated as trade secrets, so we can't see them. And yet, I mean, they can be very much manipulating our attention. And, you know, Facebook's a smart company, and the more time we spend on it, the more the more money it makes. So we should be suspicious about the kind of programming that's going on behind the scenes that determines what we're shown when we go onto these services.
Yeah, I can't remember where I heard this, but the saying that if you get anything for free, then you should know that you are the product.
That's right. You know, we're the thing that Facebook sells to advertisers. once you start thinking of it in those terms, it becomes a little creepy, and
it's
probably a good way to think about it.
Yeah, and you know, one final point I wanted to address here. This is actually from a book review you wrote. It's really a really superior book review that you wrote. I love good book reviews. You know, like when you're trying to find a good book and someone can write so well that inspires you to go read the book, it's a wonderful thing. Your review of Abby Smith Rumsey's When We Are No More, this great point that you bring out in the introduction there about the Declaration of Independence when they put it on display in 1997. And as a historian, I'm always aware of this, you know, this twofold, you know, thing that technology does for us. On the one hand, and I think the thing that we see most often is that we can do research in newspapers and, you know, in minutes that would take us, you know, days, months, maybe even years, you know, before these databases were out there. We just spoke with Mark Cheatham, who's doing the digitization of the Martin Van Buren papers to make those available. But as he pointed out there, they're making them available by digitizing them because the last project put them on microfilm, which was seen at the time as a, you know, this universal technology. Could you talk about the dangers, you know, that you talk about in this review and in some of your work about what happens when we turn, you know, our documents that we leave behind into digital documents and not paper or handwritten documents?
Right. And so there are two different concerns. One is that we aren't recording our thoughts and our activities and our negotiations and stuff on paper anymore. We're doing it digitally. And what the drafts of the Declaration of Independence show very eloquently is that having a piece of paper on which different people are editing and adding things and taking away things and crossing out things, that provides that a rich physical record of what actually went on in the room. If you think about today, you know, if the Declaration were written today, it would probably be done via email exchanges or some document in the cloud. And you probably would not see those revisions because people just throw them out or they get lost in time. And so you'd have the document, but it would lack that kind of physicality that in this kind of richness of evidence that you get. So on the one hand, you know, we by simply changing the way we're creating documents, we're probably going to leave a less rich record of what went on for future historians. And then there's also the other issue of when we transfer information from a physical form into a digital form, we tend to assume that it will be more resistant to decay or to time. Because we have this sense that anything online is going to last forever.
Right.
And in fact, what you see is that because technological standards change, because, you know, certain companies go out of business or into business, software standards change, that actually digital records are quite fragile. And they become even more fragile when we start having big centralized databases, cloud databases. It was one thing when you had the same document, you know, on thousands and thousands of hard drives. At least then you were fairly certain that some copy would survive. Now we've actually developed this, you know, storage system, digital storage system that everybody assumes is very robust and everything will be there forever, but it's actually very, very fragile. And so, you know, what the woman who wrote that book recommends, and I think she's right, is that we need to be much more conscious of the archival function that needs to be applied to all this digital information, or we're going to wake up and find that a lot of it is just gone.
Right. And as a historian who works in the 1920s, you know, if these documents, you know, oftentimes, you know, these documents that I work in the Soviet, from the Soviet Union, who knows what would have been destroyed permanently if it were that easy to do.
Right.
And so there are all types of security issues. And with the Declaration of Independence, we may not have known, if we didn't have that first draft, the irony in Thomas Jefferson writing the first draft of the Declaration of Independence and condemning slavery.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is ironic, you know, that one of the largest slave owners in the country, or he would be before the end of his life, is condemning slavery, which and that would mean that my students would have one fewer reading to do in my class. So maybe they would like it if it would have been that way.
Yeah, it's a very interesting. I mean, it goes, you know, to a point that's gone through this conversation, is that, you know, there are a lot of unintended consequences that occur when you get a new technology, and we have to be conscious of those, that you know, nothing is simple. Right. And we need to prepare ourselves for bad consequences as well as good ones.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Road to Now. The Road to Now was hosted and produced by Bob Crawford and Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. This episode is edited by Gary Fletcher. And today's music, like pretty much always, is by the wonderful Paul DeFiglia.
If you have not gone and rated us on iTunes, please do so. We need you to do that so we can spread the word about this podcast. Everyone who has, we say thank you. Speaking of thanks, we'd like to say a special thanks to everyone on Patreon who helps make this podcast possible, with a special shout out to our Washingtonians: Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Fig White, Jeff LeCain, Peggy Donica, Susan Sharp, Joseph Mann, Matt Williams, and Mariah Wolford. If you'd like to join our community of patrons and get lots of extra content, just go to patreon.com/theroadtonow and pick a tier. For as little as $5 a month, you get access to episodes 1 through 75, some extras, bonus content, and it only gets better from there. For Bob Crawford, this has been Sawyer. Thanks for listening, and take care.